From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Talk about your credentials to run for the U.S. Senate against Dianne Feinstein.
Biggest credential is that I've never been a politician. I think the credentials are is that I've been a grassroots organizer for 25 years trying to build a movement for social justice.
Today, a conversation with Global Exchange co-founder Madia Benjamin. She's running for the U.S. Senate against Republican Tom Campbell and Democrat Dianne Feinstein. Also, the latest on the Elian Gonzalez case and an update on the shooting death of a leading Haitian activist. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. government officials and Elian Gonzalez's Miami relatives will resume talks today. The Justice Department has set a deadline of tomorrow for the family to sign a pledge agreeing to turn Elian over if it loses a custody battle in court. Otherwise, the government has threatened to revoke the boy's permission to stay in the United States. This news from Japan. Prime Minister Keizo Buchi was in a coma and on artificial respiration today after suffering a stroke, and a senior cabinet minister was named acting premier amid criticism that the government had kept the crisis a secret for a full day. Abuchi, 62 years old, admitted to Tokyo's Juntendo University Hospital early Sunday. Officials stressed after an emergency cabinet meeting that Abuchi's illness would not bring any change in policy. His ruling party continued to be firmly in control. NATO troops have made their highest-level arrest among the Bosnian Serb leadership swooping at dawn on the home of former parliamentary speaker Momcilo Krajicnik. Witnesses said French soldiers with the NATO-led peacekeeping force blew down the door of his house in Pale, southeast of Sarajevo, with explosive. Krajicnik, an ally of the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic, will be sent to The Hague for trial by the UN War Crimes Tribunal. And we have this late-breaking news from Haiti. Just got a call from someone in Port-au-Prince who said that Jean-Dominique, who is the owner of Radio Haiti, has been shot and killed. We're joined on the phone right now by Kim Ives, who is editor of Haiti Progrès in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kim.
Hi, Amy.
Can you give us the latest news on Jean-Dominique and who he is?
Yeah, Jean-Dominique was the director of Radio Haiti. He was a pioneering journalist in Haiti under the Duvaliers and in the subsequent post-Duvalier period. We learned that he did die just recently. He was gravely wounded, earlier reports said, but Radio Tropic just announced that he, in fact, did die at the hospital. It seems he was ambushed in the courtyard of the radio when he went there this morning, and it's a real blow to the press and seems to be part of the campaign, which may be orchestrated by the forces of what was Duvalierism and what is recently become the coup quarter, and there has been a lot of motion and press of late, which has been suggesting that the U.S., in fact, is very unhappy with the current government stance on elections, and the attack against Jean-Dominique fits well within this kind of campaign. It looks like his death is a signal, really, to all the democracy-minded forces in Haiti that they had better be on the lookout. And indeed, there's been a lot of rumors that a coup could be taking place shortly. So we're waiting to see if this is the beginning of a week-long campaign or possibly even more.
I want to thank you for being with us, Kim Ives of Haiti Progrès, a Haitian newspaper that is published in the United States as well as Haiti. People who want the Confederate flag lowered from the South Carolina State House resume a protest march today. More than 600 people set off from Charleston, South Carolina, on a 120-mile trek to Columbia yesterday. They're calling it the Get in Step March. Charleston Mayor Joe Riley says the marchers hope to persuade state lawmakers to get in step with the people and remove the flag. The protesters plan to hold a rally in Columbia Thursday, the same day pro-flag supporters plan to hold a rally at the Capitol. And there was protest on Saturday in Florham Park, New Jersey, as the IMF conference and World Bank meeting took place there. Police had brought out mounted patrols, dogs, and metal barricades dealing with the protesters. The rally is a buildup for the major demonstrations at meetings of the two economic groups, the World Bank and the IMF, on April 16th and 17th in Washington, D.C. The European Union poured cold water yesterday on African appeals for canceling billions of dollars in debt owed European firms on the eve of the first summit between leaders of the two continents. During a pre-summit meeting of foreign ministers from both sides, the Egyptian foreign minister urged Europe to free Africa from the burden of external debt. April 9th in Washington, D.C. will be a major Jubilee 2000 rally calling for relief of the debt. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As I read in the headlines, U.S. government officials and Elian Gonzalez's Miami relatives will resume talks today. The Justice Department has set a deadline of tomorrow for the family to sign a pledge agreeing to turn Elian over if it loses a custody battle in court. Otherwise, the government has threatened to revoke the boy's permission to stay in the United States. Meanwhile, the boy's Miami distant relatives are questioning whether Elian's father is a fit parent. The father's lawyer told CNN the allegations are outrageous. In another development, Cuban President Fidel Castro says Elian's father is willing to travel alone to the U.S. today if American officials promise to turn over the boy to him and let them return to Cuba. We're joined on the telephone right now by Michael Ratner, an attorney who works with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. He has just returned from Cuba, where he has been meeting with high-level Cuban officials. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael Ratner.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, can you tell us the latest from Havana?
Well, I think when I went to Havana about almost a week ago, I think there was an air of optimism. I mean, you had Janet Reno saying, you have to the boy's family in Florida, you have to sign this agreement to turn over the boy if you lose the case. And she gave a deadline of, I think it was last Thursday. I think since then, we saw a slow deterioration of that optimism, really because Reno and Clinton and the administration have basically been falling over backwards to accommodate themselves to that, you know, the right wing, what they call the mafia in Miami. And she kept extending the deadline. They were completely shocked by it because the deadline is only about signing a piece of paper that says we will comply with the law. The family won't even do that. The so-called family won't even do that. So I think while they expect that kind of behavior from the great uncle, what I think they really didn't expect is for the United States, which is they see as the most, which it is, the most powerful country in the world, to be held hostage by a little claque or a little clique of the Miami Cubans and just keep giving way on the deadline. And when the announcement came down on after Thursday, after the negotiations were going on, that they were extending the deadline till Tuesday, I mean, I think the Cubans just couldn't believe it. They just couldn't believe that the United States Attorney General could put out a letter to the family saying, we will take that kid back if you don't sign by Thursday, then extend the date till Tuesday. Negotiations over what? They want to know. We can't figure out what's going on.
Michael, you have been meeting with high-level officials. What are they saying in Cuba right now?
Well, I think, as I said, I think one thing is they felt they were very optimistic. Now, less so. I think the they definitely want the father to come here and get the child. Again, they can't understand why that can't happen. If the father isn't going to pick up the child, then they do want to send this whole group of people, and they are willing to await the outcome of the court proceeding, which is also interesting to me. You have a court proceeding going on, but there's no injunction against Janet Reno turning the boy over immediately. And yet the Cubans are willing to come in and wait. So what they see themselves as being incredibly accommodating, and yet the United States officials are being, whatever you want to call them, incredibly incredibly political. The mood in Cuba, I think, is still, you know, hopeful in the sense that they can't. It's such a shocking thing to them that this kidnapping would occur. They still can't believe that in the end they're not going to get Elian back to his father. But they're trying everything. They're trying to understand the entire legal proceedings. What they don't really understand is how basically a court ruling could come down. There not being any injunction, and yet at the same time that the family can still hold on to the child.
What about this latest charge of the families that Juan Miguel Gonzalez, Elian's father, abuses him? What was the reaction in Cuba?
Just incredulous, I think. They say, you know, dredging it up from way back. I mean, first of all, if people have ever been to Cuba, they know how Cuban people treat their children and how parents treat their children. And there's been no evidence from anybody who's gone to that town, any reporters from the United States who've gone to that town, who've interviewed all the family, who've interviewed friends, reporters who are not particularly favorable to Cuba, no evidence whatsoever that the father abused his child.
Would the reason this would be brought up now, as opposed to it would have been the strongest information to have at the beginning, is that once this goes into a custody court, I mean, you've got these people of unequal standing, distant relatives versus the father. It seems that the relatives don't have a leg to stand on, but that's where this information becomes relevant.
Right. That would be it could be relevant to Janet Reno's decision to say the boy speaks for the father and that there's, you know, in the asylum application, but it's correct. It's more relevant in the family court, which is where, you know, the statement by Vice President Gore was particularly outrageous when he said, we want to hear this thing. We want this heard in a family court. The family court has no jurisdiction of this case at all, and no jurisdiction unless the kid is made a permanent resident or citizen. And, of course, in my view and view of most law professors, that's utterly and completely unconstitutional to do that to the child.
Let's talk about Vice President Gore's decision to break with President Clinton. I'm wondering if you see it as it appears on the surface, with Gore saying that he felt that the child should stay here, a number of lawmakers expressing open contempt for a move they felt further politicized this family tragedy. Among them, New York Democrat Jose Serrano. He said that he was shocked and outraged by Gore's endorsement of legislation that would extend permanent residence status to Elian, his father, and other relatives living in Cuba. He noted the unfairness of extending resident status to a Cuban father who's not seeking it, when many Latino immigrants from other nations, as well as Haitians and Africans who desperately want resident status, are turned down. And he asked Gore, where are your family values? Don't you believe this small child should be with the father who loves him?
Yes, Serrano's statement was excellent, but you know, there's a lot of opposition coming from the Republicans. There was a statement by Steve Largent, a Republican from Oklahoma, saying, I don't want anything to do with this legislation. This boy should be, I'm a father, this boy should be sent back to his father immediately. It's the best interest that this child be sent back quickly. So I can't, I mean, Gore is out there, I mean, the only thing that rings in my mind is money, money, money. The date Elian came to this country, on that date, Gore had already raised $360,000, from the Cuban community in Miami. Today it might be $500,000 by this time. So I think what we're talking about, I mean, maybe we're talking about votes, but I think we're talking about he owed a favor, he did it, he showed himself to have no backbone. I mean, it's unfortunately, in my experience with the Democrats, typical of what happens on these kind of issues. And it's really where the fault lies, not just with Gore, as I said, but with really Clinton, who is obviously today as we talk, Amy, they could go take that child. There's no court order saying they can't take that child back. There's nothing. They just need the guts and the backbone to do it.
Why do you think they're not at this point? And do you think what would happen in Miami would be a kind of Little Rock situation where you've got the, you know, the National Guard moving in and you've got the vow of the mayor of Miami, who's a Democrat, but said the police would not help in taking Elian?
Well, the question is, you know, what's happening each time something happens where Reno or Clinton move a little bit more aggressively, the Miami community seems to be able to, or the right wingers there seem to be able to bluff them back and say, we're not going to help enforce the law, we're not going to sign this paper, we're not going to do this. And each time, our government seems to fall victim to the bluff. So I think, to a large extent, they're bluffing. But even if they're not bluffing, how can they basically allow what was we called in the 60s the doctrine of interposition, which is the southern states interposing themselves between the federal government and the law and saying, go do it to us, like you said, as you mentioned in Little Rock. That's what it is. I can't imagine that if there's backbone by our government that will happen. If they say to them and if they say to the Miami mayor, we're coming to take that child back, I can't imagine that basically they won't just basically give up the child. I mean, I don't believe that they will be required to use any real degree of force. They're just bluffing this government. This government has been afraid of doing much. They have pious words, but so far craven acts. You know, I'm still hopeful, but as more hopeful to morning this morning, now that, of course, the father is willing to come to the United States alone, or if they won't give him the child, then the family is willing to come as well.
Now, the family has said on television that they would hand the child over to Juan Gonzalez, the father, but not to INS officials, although other family members in talking with Univision with the Spanish media were not saying that.
You know, I think this family, this great uncle, these people have been talking out of both sides of their mouth from the beginning. Each time they say they're going to do something, they withdraw it or some other lawyer withdraws it. I saw the statement yesterday also that said, oh, we'll comply with the law. But that's one lawyer saying it. You have Lazaro, the great uncle, saying something else sometimes. You have another lawyer saying something else. They obviously can't be trusted. They're going to string this thing out as long as they can, trying to get as much publicity as they can. They're going to try and obviously, even the fact that they have to await now a court hearing in the Court of Appeals in the 11th Circuit, which is to take place on May 11th, possibly not having a decision till June, makes no sense at all here. None at all. They could take the kid away tomorrow. The other thing that when I was in Cuba that hit them very strongly, that they were extremely upset about, was the Diane Sawyer interview with Elian. They weren't necessarily upset about the content. I mean, you know, they understand propaganda in the United States just as you and I do. What they were really upset about was the exploitation of Elian by Diane Sawyer. They couldn't believe it, that they could get out, that Diane Sawyer could get into a children's playroom with Elian, get on the floor with him, and have him actually draw pictures of what happened to him on the sea, you know, with his mother, when he lost his mother. I mean, is Diane Sawyer a psychologist? Is this healthy for a child? They thought it was utter exploitation of the child. And what they couldn't understand is how you can give a child to a family and then Diane Sawyer Janet Reno couldn't impose conditions on that family, which she can, of course, and not even a minor condition saying you have no right to put that kid on TV. Janet Reno turns that kid over under a certain set of conditions. One of those conditions, of course, is that they have to return the boy when she says, which they obviously said they won't do. But secondly, she could add a condition that says you can't put the boy on TV. She hasn't done it. It's basically child abuse what's going on with that family right now. And I think the Cubans are just floored by something like that. I mean, when this child comes back to Cuba, they've made a commitment that he will not be exploited. He will not be put on TV. He will just go back to his family and try and reintegrate Encarnas with the rest of his classmates. They have that commitment. Apparently, our country doesn't.
Do you think Juan Gonzalez faces danger if he comes to the United States?
Oh, I think it's I think they're taking a high risk, particularly if he goes into Miami. I think they could, you know, practically imprison the guy, if not shoot him. I mean, those people have shown themselves to be extremely, extremely dangerous, and I think it's a big worry.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Michael Ratner. If people want to get more information on the case, where can they go on the web?
Well, there are a number of sites just devoted to Elian, if you do a search on Elian. On a site that the center has with me called humanrightsnow.org, there's a letter to INS on Elian. There's a piece on how it's illegal to give him citizenship, there's some other stuff. But there's a bunch of, search engines that put up everything, on Elian.
Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights. When we return, we'll be speaking with Medea Susan Benjamin. She is a grassroots activist for more than 20 years, and she's running for the U.S. Senate in California. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend in New York, the Socialist Scholars Conference took place. Hundreds of people gather from around the country every year for this annual meeting. And on Sunday afternoon, I had gone over to see Howard Zinn's play, Marx in Soho, and I bumped into Medea Benjamin. She's the co-founder of Global Exchange in San Francisco. She had just come out of a session that she was participating in on the World Trade Organization, as well as the World Bank and the IMF, with preparations for the big protests that are going to be taking place in Washington the week leading up to April 16th and 17th. And she handed me a flyer. It said, there is a choice, Medea Susan Benjamin for U.S. Senate. Inside, it says, in the aftermath of the Seattle protests against the corporate bias World Trade Organization, I'm more convinced than ever the majority of Americans agree that we need a society that puts human needs and the environment before corporate profits. Medea Benjamin is running for Senate against Dianne Feinstein, the Democratic incumbent, heavily favored to win, and Tom Campbell, California Congress member, the Republican. I sat down with Medea at the event, and I talked to her about how she came to this decision.
It really was a post-Seattle decision. You know, coming out of Seattle, we just felt this kind of sense of, you know, we got to keep this momentum going. And where are these discussions about these critical trade issues happening in the political scene? When I looked in California and I saw Dianne Feinstein's record, it's just appalling. She's been a fervent supporter of every free trade agreement from NAFTA to NAFTA for Africa. She helped clinch the deal with China to help get China into the WTO. And she's the only Democrat in the entire Senate that took a stand against the state of Burma for not wanting to do business with Burma. So against the state of Massachusetts for not wanting to do business with Burma. So when you look at her record, it's absolutely appalling. And, you know, is this what we want representing us in California? So I felt after Seattle, we've got the momentum. We're putting it together in terms of the new protests that we're organizing in Washington around the IMF World Bank, around the conventions in the Democrat and Republican Party in the summer. But we have to have a positive alternative, too. And I think Ralph Nader is an amazing candidate for the Green Party. And to be able to go around the state as a Green Party candidate in California with a message of fair trade, living wage, let's not put our money into prisons but put them into the schools, let's have not have GMO foods, but safe, healthy, organic foods and support family farmers. These are positive issues that we want to get out into the public, and this is one way to do it.
So what is the process that you went through?
Well, I was approached by the Green Party and asked to run, including by Ralph Nader. And so we had a primary March 7th between me and another Green Party candidate. I won that primary. And so as of March 7th, I am the Green Party's candidate. And now focusing my attention on Dianne Feinstein and her opponent, the Republican Tom Campbell.
Are you on the ballot?
Yes, I'm on the ballot, definitely.
And did you have to gather signatures? Do you have to raise money? What are you doing?
We gathered the signatures we needed to get on the ballot, so that's already done. And now in terms of raising money, we got to raise a lot of money, because I think as people know who followed Ralph Nader's campaign last time, you can't do a serious campaign and not raise money. So we want to raise a couple $100,000, and we've already hired staff. I have staff in Northern California. We want to hire staff in Southern California. In the short time that I've been campaigning, I've been going all around the state. I'm back and forth to the L.A. area just about every week now. Just went to Fresno, Modesto, Sacramento. It's been exciting, and we're going to make this a real campaign.
We're talking to Medea Benjamin, who is a Green Party candidate for the Senate in California, and she is running against Dianne Feinstein. You know, a lot of people have wanted to see change in national politics, but I don't think most people understand the mechanisms to get there. On the issue of raising money, what are your limits? I mean, what are the rules that you have set?
Well, obviously, I won't take any PAC money, won't take any corporate money, not that they would want to give it to me. It's individual money, and according to the rules, $1,000 is the limit. We need to get lots of donations, and we are getting $1,000 donations coming in. Actually, even unsolicited $1,000 donations, unsolicited $500 donations, and lots of $25 donations. We have a website. It's www.mediaforsenate, all written out, mediaforsenate.org. And we're now getting ready to take credit card donations over the web. So this is serious, and I think the fact that we're getting in these already unsolicited donations means that people are excited about this campaign.
Does this mean you'll be in debates?
Well, it's very interesting. I just met Dianne Feinstein yesterday at the Feminist Expo in Washington and went up and gave her one of my flyers and said, I'm running against you on the Green Party ticket, and I hope we'll have a chance to debate. And her mouth dropped open and said, well, good luck, and walked away. I am meeting with Tom Campbell, the Republican, actually this week to talk to him about a series of debates, which is in his interest, actually, because he is so far behind her. So we're thinking of all kinds of creative ways where we can challenge both the Republicans and Democrats to debates. And if the Republican will agree to debate, which is quite probable, Dianne Feinstein will only look terrible by having an empty seat there.
Who decides in California who is in the official debates?
Well, it depends. Sometimes the debates are organized by the Los Angeles Times, for example. Sometimes it's League of Women Voters. So we have to talk to both the people who have traditionally organized debates as well as get other groups that haven't traditionally organized debates and ask them to organize and invite all of the candidates.
You were just on a panel on the World Trade Organization. You're headed to Washington for the big events that are planned for the 16th and the 17th to close down the annual meetings of the World Bank and the IMF. Can you talk about how you're organizing in California and around the country?
Well, there's tremendous excitement in California and around the country. In fact, there's caravans from California that are moving across the country as we speak right now. Post-Seattle, when we have planning meetings for things, we used to have maybe 10 people. Now we have 60 people. When we used to have discussions around the World Trade Organization, we'd have 50. Now we have 400. You know, there's a tremendous amount of organizing going on, and people are seeing mass mobilizations as, you know, a renewal of public participation on these issues. So we have the same kind of affinity groups that we had around the World Trade Organization. We have the same kind of decentralized structure. We have the same kind of creativity that comes out of the decentralization. And this kind of mass movement, I think, is the most frustrating for our opponents because there is no head. It's multi-headed. And you'll have seen the same kind of thing in Washington.
So let's talk about why the protest goes from the World Trade Organization, as we saw in Seattle, to the World Bank and the IMF, how that fits in, and also what you're going to be saying about it in your Senate race.
Well, this is the unholy trinity of the three organizations that set the rules for the global economy, and they're the exact same rules that say focus your economy on exports, not on production for local consumption, cut down your budgets, you're spending too much on education, you're spending too much on health care. This kind of thing that we see going on with structural adjustment around the world, we see in California. California is the richest state in the richest nation in this world. We are awash in money. There are more and more billionaires in California every single day. And yet we have a horrendous public school system. We have 38,000 people a month in California alone that are losing their health care, more than any other state in the country. We have public transportation system that is absolutely horrendous. We have a corporate agriculture that is wiping out small farmers. So we need land reform in California. We need money put into basics of universal health care, the public school system, public transportation, the same kind of issues that we were fighting around the World Bank and the IMF are the same kind of policies that we need to fight in California. There's no reason there should be one person in the state of California going hungry or not having health care.
Medea Benjamin, you recently went to China. What is your feeling about China and the World Trade Organization? In the week that'll start with the big April 9th rally for debt relief that Jubilee 2000 is going to be putting on, to the AFL-CIO will be leading their march against allowing China into World Trade Organization. Talk about what you saw in China.
Well, I think the focus of the movement should be on U.S. corporations in China, because it really is appalling to see that U.S. corporations are bringing standards down. I was looking into the shoe factories. The kind of chemicals that are not allowed to be used in the United States in factories like benzene and toluene are being used liberally in China. And the amazing thing is that decades ago, in the state factories, these were not allowed. And it's because of the foreign companies coming in that standards in China are actually getting lower than they were before. So we have to focus not so much on bashing the Chinese government, but the U.S. corporations that are really in the forefront and the ones that are gaining most from the race to the bottom.
What do you think having China in the WTO would mean?
Well, I think China and the WTO is actually a very contradictory thing. I think we should fight against China having most favored nation status and against China and the WTO, because it would only strengthen the WTO. But I think it should be in the context of trying to weaken the WTO in general. In fact, I think we should have a movement to get the U.S. out of the WTO. So anything we can do to weaken the WTO is a good thing. And, of course, keeping the largest country in the world out would help to weaken the WTO.
Talk about your credentials to run for the U.S. Senate against Dianne Feinstein.
Biggest credential is that I've never been a politician. I think the credentials are is that I've been a grassroots organizer for 25 years trying to build a movement for social justice. And I feel that we are on the wave of a new kind of mobilizing. And it's very exciting. And that we have to have it in all levels of our activism. We have to build these organizations, like my own organization, Global Exchange, has been growing tremendously. And we have to build our voice in the political realm. So I think that we want to have politicians who are grassroots activists, who have dedicated their lives to social justice, whose first priority is to bring more equality into our system. That's what politicians should be about, not in the hands and pockets of corporations.
I'm looking at your flyer, Green Party, There Is a Choice, Medea Susan Benjamin for U.S. Senate. People may know that you're founding director of the San Francisco-based human rights group Global Exchange, and that you're a well-known community activist. What about your other background and your involvement in academics? I didn't know you were a nutritionist, for example.
Well, I have several graduate degrees in economics and in public health nutrition. I used to work for the United Nations. I spent about 10 years in Africa and Latin America and went back to the U.S. looking at food and farming issues in the United States, always with the idea of how do you build more sustainable models of development. So my focus has always been how do you put priority on the family farm? How do you put priority on microcredit, on small business? How do you build up local and regional communities? Of course, that's the opposite that everything like the WTO stands for. But I think in more and more as we look for creative solutions to the problems that we have, both locally and globally, it comes down to building more sustainable models of development, both ecologically sustainable and ones that are bring up the bottom.
You lived in Cuba. The big story dominating the headlines is the story of Elian Gonzalez, the six-year-old who is being held by his distant relatives in Florida. We will see if his father does come up into the United States. We have an interesting national presidential race breakdown on this, and that is that the two leading candidates are on the same side, Al Gore and George W. Bush, saying he should stay in the United States. And then you have, it looks like, President Clinton and Fidel Castro on the other side saying that he should go back to Cuba. Can you talk about your feelings about this?
Well, of course, this kid is a pawn. This kid should obviously go back with his biological father and his entire extended family that is waiting for him in Cuba. But I think bringing it in the broader context, we should be talking about the need to end the embargo in Cuba. We should be talking about the need to end the embargo against Iraq, that when you have a policy where you kill 5,000 children a month as part of a, quote, legitimate foreign policy, that something is wrong with that. So as part of my campaign, I want to talk about foreign policy issues and not just focus on the case of one boy, but focus on the case of entire peoples and thousands of children who are being hurt by U.S. policy.
Immigration is certainly a big issue in California, and it's interesting to see people like Florida Governor Jeb Bush, the brother of George W. Bush,
said that he's for this going through the court system, Elian's case. It's interesting considering he's part of a movement that is increasingly cutting down on the rights of immigrants. They don't have a right to go to court. It's not clear. It's almost as if they're saying the INS has no place in this. What about the rights of immigrants in California, and what is your attitude on the issue of immigration?
Well, I think there's been a really positive change in the feeling about immigrants in California since we had the horrendous propositions to cut services to immigrants. There is now a feeling that with the AFL-CIO's change in policy towards talking about a blanket amnesty for immigrants, that this is a time to really start projecting the need for amnesty, the need for, when we talk about labor rights, that if immigrants don't have the right to organize within the workplace, then that brings down the rights of all workers. So I think it's a positive atmosphere because there is supposedly this low level of unemployment that we can start talking about how much immigrant communities contribute to the economy. And certainly in California, were it not for the immigrants, we wouldn't have food on our tables. But it is a much better atmosphere than it was just a couple of years ago to talk about the need for amnesty, the need for immigrant rights.
Have you heard about the CIA report on slave labor in the United States?
Oh, yes. I heard that there's a new report talking about tens of thousands of immigrants coming to the United States in all kinds of capacities used as slave labor. We have been focusing on the island of Saipan, where the indentured servitude is rampant, not only in the garment industry, but also in the sex trade. And most recently, we had a very important victory last week in that we had 17 companies that we have a lawsuit against because of the use of indentured servitude in the island of Saipan, which is a U.S. territory. We settled with 17 companies, bringing us $8 million to use to monitor the situation so that women aren't brought into the United States with bonds over their heads of $10,000 that they have to repay and work for an entire year just to pay that back. So that is one example where we've done something positive to end slavery in the island of Saipan.
What are some of the companies that have settled, and how were they gotten to settle?
Well, it's part of this grassroots movement. You know, the lawsuit is one thing, but they would have easily just let it go for years and years through the court system had it not been for a grassroots anti-sweatshop movement. And the fact that we get out on the streets and protest against these companies really puts the heat on them. So we had all kinds of companies settling, from Nordstrom's to Calvin Klein to Ralph Lauren and Liz Claiborne. The largest company that is still producing on the island of Saipan and has refused to settle as the Gap. So we are actually redoubling our efforts. We used to have a monthly day of demonstrations against the Gap. I think we've got to ramp that up to probably weekly demonstrations.
Are you concerned that these corporations are going to pour money into your opponents' campaigns, given how well known you are for being one of the leaders of the anti-sweatshop movement?
Well, I don't think they need to do that because they've already done it. In fact, when I look at Dianne Feinstein's campaign contributions, the Gap is right up there. Chevron, Texaco, Oxy Petroleum, all the oil companies that we've been fighting against are right up there. The mining companies like Freeport-McMoRan that have the most horrendous reputation in places like Indonesia are among her campaign contributors. So certainly it won't take my entering the race to have her be in bed with some of the worst corporations that exist.
And what is your response to those who say you will be taking votes away from the Democrat if you enter the race? You're running against Tom Campbell. Among the national issues he's known for is opposing the bombing of Yugoslavia. In fact, he was one of the leaders in a lawsuit against the U.S. government for that.
Yes, it's quite amazing. In this race, he's actually more progressive on a lot of issues than Dianne Feinstein is. On foreign policy issues, he's against the embargo in Iraq. He has came out against Proposition 21, which was the proposition that was is to treat youth offenders as adults, and Dianne Feinstein would not come out against that. He's pro-choice. Exactly like she is in terms of fair trade. He prides himself on being a fiscal conservative. So on those issues, they are quite alike. In terms of the old argument of taking votes away from the Democrats, you know, it's time we got ourselves out of the box and started looking at a larger framework, because when I look around and I travel around the world and I find really interesting debates and discussions and real popular participation in the political process, it's countries that have a real multi-party system. It's countries that have proportional representation, so that if there's 10 seats open and you get 20% of the votes, you're going to get 2 seats. It's been shown that where there is proportional representation in multi-party systems, the number of people that come out for votes gets into the 70s, sometimes in the 80%. So I think the only way we're going to get a really dynamic, interesting political system in which the majority of people feel it's worth their while to participate is if we break out of the box of these Democrats and Republicans.
Medea Benjamin, running for the U.S. Senate. We're going to come back to this conversation with her, a candidate for the California Senate seat of Dianne Feinstein, when we come back here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with well-known human rights activist Medea Benjamin. She is co-founder of the San Francisco-based human rights group Global Exchange, and now she's running for the U.S. Senate in California for the seat of Dianne Feinstein. I got a chance to speak with her yesterday at the Socialist Scholars Conference in New York.
You know Errol Maitland because you've been on Democracy Now! A number of times. He's the technical director. He was out in Seattle with all of us out on the streets covering the police crackdown on the protests and the protesters raising their voice against the World Trade Organization and closing it down. He was taken down by police last Saturday, remains in coronary intensive care in New York. As he was telling them, he was live on WBAI and asking the police questions. They struck him down. You've got the Los Angeles Police Department and the continuing unfolding of the scandal around police brutality and corruption there. What are your recommendations for the issue of police brutality and misconduct?
Well, I think it's gotten to the point where we have to recognize we live in a police state, and this police state is horrendous. And the kind of police brutality that's happening in New York City, Los Angeles, and all around the country is absolutely unacceptable. We have to fight it, not only the police brutality, but the prison industrial complex. I mean, the fact that we have 2 million people behind bars, the majority of them people of color, we know that the kind of leveling of focus put on incarcerating youth in California has brought the youth out into the streets like never before. Just like the issues around police brutality are getting people in New York and Los Angeles out on the street like never before. So this is an issue that we have to see as part of a corporate agenda, part of an agenda to put away those who protest against the system. I think in the case of Earl, it brings it down home so closely. And certainly as part of my campaign, I will focus my energy on talking about what kind of society do we want to live in? Do we want a society where we allow the police to commit acts of brutality against us for protesting their police brutality? Do we want a society that puts our money into educating our youth or to throwing our youth in jail? Do we want a society that's turning into one where we put more money into prisons than higher education? I mean, it's absolutely insanity at this point, and certainly it will be a major issue that I bring up everywhere I go in the campaign.
You've got a powerful lobby against you, and it is the Prison Guard Lobby of California, which I believe is something like the second most powerful lobby in the state.
Yes. On the other hand, we have a powerful movement that, although we did not win Proposition 21, which is the proposition that was to put youth, to treat youth as adults and incarcerate our young people at a greater rate than they're being incarcerated now, there's a tremendous amount of mobilizing and organizing that came out of that. And I feel it's part of my candidacy to keep that mobilizing going and to make it part of the broader movement of where do we want to put our tax dollars. It costs more to send somebody to prison than it does to send them to Stanford University, to say nothing of our public school system in California. So we have to talk about changing priorities. We have to talk about why we are number 41 in the state of California when it comes to putting money into schools and number one when it comes to putting money into prisons. So there is a powerful movement against the prison industrial complex, and we're going to keep working against it.
As you made your decision about whether or not to run for Senate, what were the cons?
The cons are, one, my life is totally full with the activism I'm doing and the family I have, and I have two kids, so certainly getting time to be with the family. The other is putting yourself out there as a public figure, and I think we tend in our movements to want to build our movements, not want to build ourselves individually, and I certainly don't like having to build myself individually. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel good. But yet, on the other hand, you think, you know, we got to speak out. We got to keep pushing these issues, and that we have to push ourselves to do it. So it's uncomfortable. When I talked about the great thing about the protests that are going on now, it's that there isn't a figure. There are so many of us. When you get into politics, you have to start saying, vote for me. It starts to become a me kind of thing. I don't want it to be that, and I certainly am pushing the Green Party because I think we have to build parties. And I'm excited that one of the best things my campaign can do in California is build the Green Party in California to be less of a white male party. Diversity is a very important issue to me and the people that I'm working with in this campaign, and I think we can use the campaign to really build the Greens.
On the issue of money, Medea Benjamin, Emily's list, the early money is like yeast that supports women. What have they told you?
Well, I've been told by people at Emily's List that they only support Democrats and that they are supporters of Dianne Feinstein because we have so few women in the Senate. We need to support those who are there. I'm going to still try among other people in Emily's List because I think there are many progressives within that group who wouldn't see Dianne Feinstein as the kind of woman that they would want representing them. So I certainly am going to keep trying. But it does become evident the more you start looking around for support that we have to create more ways for progressive women to have access to money you need to run campaigns, because you need money. You know, without money, you can't have staff. Without staff, you don't have a campaign.
Mm-hmm. And what about the National Women's Political Caucus?
Well, I've been told that they support Republicans and Democrats and are not open to third parties. I think we have to challenge all of this, and certainly we will be challenging it at the local level. There are women's groups in California that might be more open to us than, let's say, nationally. But it seems just on the kind of superficial discussions we've had that they're really locked into the two mainstream parties.
And finally, ads. Will you be taking out ads in California?
Well, we're already thinking of all kinds of creative ads that we can do. We want to do radio ads because they're certainly doable. They're cheaper. I've talked to people who said you got to have like one TV ad. That Wellstone and his campaign had one great TV ad, and that ad becomes a press issue in and of itself. So depending on how much money you raise, love to do some ads. We also have friends who are artists who want to do creative billboards and all kinds of things that we can do that don't require lots of money. You know, when you do a grassroots campaign, which is what a green campaign should and must be, you have to have ways to counter the traditional way of throwing lots of money into TV ads because we don't have it.
And is the press paying attention?
The press has been terrible. The press has been terrible about Ralph Nader's campaign. You know, when he announced his campaign, all the major TV stations were there, and none of them carried it in the news. Wherever he goes, it's really hard to treat him like the true presidential material that he is. And I think the same is true for me. We had I've had great meetings. The largest alternative weeklies in California have endorsed me in a resounding fashion in terms of the LA Weekly. The LA Weekly said that I've done more for social justice than 97 of the senators already in Senate, and San Francisco Bay Guardian has been very supportive. We also had a great support from the Sacramento Bee. I met last week with the Fresno Bee, had a very good meeting. So we're trying to get meetings with the Los Angeles Times. The mainstream media so far is ignoring me, which means to us that we have to do two things. One, we have to get people who are interested in the campaign to really be bugging the media, calling them, protesting when they keep talking about this Senate race as only Dianne Feinstein and Tom Campbell, and keep reminding them there is a third party candidate, a Green Party candidate. We want to hear her voice. And the other thing is finding more creative ways of creating debates. For example, we're thinking of doing using the high-tech road and creating a debate over the internet, where we would try to get Tom Campbell and Dianne Feinstein to be part of that, and getting one of the Silicon Valley companies to sponsor that. We're looking at ways that we can get mass-based organizations in California to organize debates, then get push to get the candidates to come and push to get the press. But it's going to be an uphill battle to get the mainstream press to take us seriously.
What about the possibility of Dianne Feinstein being named as a vice presidential running mate for Al Gore?
Well, that's the wild card in this whole thing, which actually makes it so interesting, because then another Democrat will have to come in to take her seat, and who knows who that would be. It's interesting in the case of Dianne Feinstein. She's seen as such a shoe-in in this race, not because people like her or because she's done anything great for the state in terms of policies. It's because she has so much money. She has $15 million for a race where she is way ahead of the Republican. So I think if she were named as a vice presidential candidate, it would open up the whole ball of wax, and we'd have a very interesting campaign on our hands.
Okay. Who's your campaign manager?
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, a conversation that I was having with Medea Benjamin yesterday.
Dianne Feinstein is awful. Everything from her support of the death penalty, her support of this prison industrial complex, her lack of support for universal health care, her support of and her support of all the free trade agreements, and use these issues in the campaign in a creative fashion. For example, when the issue of the Massachusetts right to not buy goods from Burma came up to the Supreme Court on March 22nd, we did an action at Dianne Feinstein's office in San Francisco, and they had the police out there in full force, would not let us up to her office. And so we did our rally downstairs. We had Supervisor Tom Ammiano, who was the one who actually brought the legislation to San Francisco to not do business with Burma. We had him there, and we had such a crowd that her chief of staff had to come down and address the crowd. And he said, well, we couldn't bring you upstairs because there were so many of you, but we had to come out here and address the masses, his words. And so we actually got onto the local television station questions around that. So during the campaign, I think there will, unfortunately, because she is so bad on so many issues, there'll be many chances for us to use this as a way to show the need for an alternative.
Well, if people want to get in touch with you, either to voice their criticism or their support, where can they call? Where can they go on the web?
And, of course, if they want to get in touch to be a financial contributor and help us run a really strong campaign, please contact www.mediaforsenate.org. Media for Senate, MediaForSenate.org.
And is there a phone number?
Yes, you can call us at 415-701-7090.
And this is it. You're full scale in the race right now.
Off running, visiting all of California. If you're listening and want to invite me to your community, please do so. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Medea Benjamin, Medea Susan Benjamin. There is a choice. She's running for the U.S. Senate. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
And that conversation took place yesterday at the Socialist Scholars Conference in New York. Medea Benjamin then flew back to California. Today she meets with her Republican rival, California Congressmember Tom Campbell. And we have this late-breaking story. As we said at the beginning of the program, the owner of a Haitian radio station, a special advisor to Haitian President René Préval, was shot and killed on his way to work early today. Jean Dominique is director and owner of Radio Haiti en Terre. He was fired on as he arrived at work at Delma Street, one of the main thoroughfares in the capital of Port-au-Prince. We go down to Port-au-Prince right now, where Laurie Richardson, who is a freelance writer, is standing by. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Laurie.
Thank you, Amy.
You've just been to the hospital where Jean Dominique was taken. Can you tell us the situation right now?
A very intense atmosphere where members of the family are trying to deal with the grief that they're feeling. Jean Dominique's wife, there are also members of the station there, obviously, and police coming in and out, reporters arriving. Jean Dominique's wife, in a very emotional statement, said to the rest of the members of the team, she said, "We're going to continue to do our job. We're going to continue with the station in the way that we conceived of it. We must all promise that this radio won't fall. We will continue as we were. Promise me this." It was very emotional.
Jean Dominique is a longtime political activist. Give us a little background on him.
Yes, he purchased the station in 1968 under the Duvalier dictatorship, and his main contribution, an incredible revolutionary contribution here in Haiti, was to introduce Creole, the Haitian Creole, over the news broadcasts. Normally it was French, which most people in Haiti do not speak, and also to introduce actual news bit by bit on the station. It was very important during the 70s, and it contributed heavily to the overthrow of the Duvalier dictatorship. And since then, the station has been attacked on a number of occasions. He was forced into exile in 1980 for 5 years. He spent a good part of that in New York. Was also forced into exile during the 1991 coup. But the station is it's a frontline station down here, very important in the democratic movement, which strives to give the microphone, to give the voice to the voiceless, to use a cliche, but really to bring in people from outside of Port-au-Prince, poor people, peasants, workers, and to let them be heard.
Well, Laurie Richardson, I want to thank you for being with us from Port-au-Prince. Freelance writer just came back from the hospital where Jean Dominique was brought after he was shot this morning. Jean Dominique, well-known Haitian activist, advisor to the president, René Préval, shot dead earlier this morning. Not clear who did it and what was the motive. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love, Karen Palmer, and Maria Carrion. Our technical director, Errol Maitland, remains hospitalized in intensive care because he was covering the funeral of the Haitian-American gunned down by police. He was struck down by police. Matthew Finch is our engineer today. If you'd like to reach us, you can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!